Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from Business Radio X Studios. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating the heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of our elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Brad Culp. It's February 16th. It's a beautiful day in Atlanta and a beautiful day in Dallas, and I think we're all ready for a break in the winter weather. I've got Lee Cantor and Sam Grass in the studio with me this morning in Atlanta. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
How are you today, Brad?
I'm doing just fine. The sun's shining. It's a good day.
It's a treat to have you both here today.
It's unique.
For a change.
Don't know if it's a treat, but it is unique.
I don't know if it's a treat for Sam, but...
And it's a treat to have Dallas with us, having missed 2 weeks due to ice.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, I'm from up north. I kind of like the snow, but I'm afraid to say that someone will backhand me before I get it out of my mouth.
If it wouldn't make a noise in the microphone. Right? Well, just for old time's sake, we're going to go do a little trivia this morning because we have some life-changing events in our history.
It is a unique day.
So 159 years ago, the Studebaker Wagon Company was formed. Studebaker was the precursor, of course, to the automobile. All right. Who's whispering?
What's the precursor to an automobile?
Well, I guess it was a wagon.
Oh, okay.
So wasn't Studebaker a car manufacturer as well?
Eventually they were, yeah. They started in wagons, and they, unlike the buggy whip manufacturers, made it into the next century.
So what was the first name of the gentleman who started the Studebaker Wagon Company?
You know, I'm going to let you research
Something
that
stupid.
And let us know next week.
I just assumed that you would have all this good information.
The other life-changing event, 74 years ago, Wallace Carruthers got a patent on nylon. That changed our lives. And 40
didn't change my life. It changed my wife's life, and not my life, son.
Well, it changed your pocketbook, I guarantee it. And 43 years ago in Haleyville, Alabama, the first 911 call. So with that, we're going to move to somebody you call when you don't call 911. And that we've – oh, you know what? I'm getting ahead of myself because I was going to put Atlanta first. But, Kevin, I'm going to – send it back to you first, and we've got two guests in Dallas this morning, and Kevin, I'll let you introduce them.
All right. Thanks, Brad. Joining me today, I have Dan Borland and John Cowan. They are with Coldwell Banker Apex Realtors. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Dan, let's start with you. Why don't you just give us a little bit of your background, where you're from, how you got to where you are today?
Well, I originally was born in Lubbock, Texas, out in West Texas, and I went to Texas Tech, graduated there, lived in the Dallas area well over 30 years, spent a large part of my career in the office products industry, came back from overseas in 2004, and went into the real estate business. And the saying goes, I wish I'd have done it 20 years ago. But better late than never.
All right. And John, what about you?
Native Texan, fourth generation, grew up in Houston, University of Houston Business School, 73. First career, wholesale building materials, gave me an opportunity to do a lot of interesting things, even ended up out in with some very intricate millwork. It was fun. Second career, went into medical business, outpatient imaging centers here in the Dallas area and then some nationally. And then I've personally done real estate for over 32 years and decided to go full-time real estate. And also about 4 or 5 years ago, I went ahead and became licensed and gave me an interesting mix because I had the medical background. Which gives me quite a concern about a lot of the people out there in different circumstances and the real estate. So I've had a fun time to mix the two.
Yeah. So one of the things that interests me about what you do and the reason I asked you if you'd be interested in coming on was you specialize in real estate, selling homes for seniors who are moving on to that next stage in their life. I know it's a broad question, but what are some things that make that market unique? Makes selling a home for a senior different than selling somebody who may be on their first home?
There's a big difference. The senior market, you ask a lot of it's just asking questions of why are they wanting to sell their home? Why are they wanting to move to a facility? Is it to be closer to children, to their kids? Is it a medical issue? Are they not able to take care? Personal example that I've got, my mother-in-law, who is 94, soon to be, she got tired of taking care of her house. She didn't want to keep up with the maintenance, the yard, the air conditioner, everything that homeowners go through. So there's a lot of questions, and there's not one specific answer. It's a combination of things.
Okay. John, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think some of the current examples that we've seen in this market, obviously, we're in a real estate interesting few years here, and that creates a lot of concern for anyone, and we're all related to real estate. But especially, I think, our seniors, even more of a concern because they're trying to make a life decision on how to move forward. And so if they are, as Dan's mother-in-law, trying to get out of the upkeep and responsibilities of that home, but yet they need the assets possibly to pay for that next step in their life. A current example would be a gentleman that had his house on the market for a year. In this market, it was priced too high. But he said, I don't want to sell it for any less. He was fortunate. He was able to move out and go into an independent care facility without having that income. But he still carried the baggage and liability of that house sitting on the market for over a year, not selling. And the family asked me to come in, take a look at the situation, and could there be any other thoughts that I had? And I think what I had, really wanted to concentrate on is presenting maybe some different thoughts that they may not think about initially. And in that particular situation, I made a recommendation that we lease the home, and we did so, and it created about $18,000 of revenue for him coming in instead of an empty house sitting there that he had to maintain utilities and the liability of upkeep. And we may have found a tenant that is interested actually in purchasing the home at the end of that one-year period.
All right.
So it was a great opportunity for him to have income coming in, which he didn't necessarily have to have, but he enjoys having it.
Sure.
And it took a responsibility off of him.
Okay. One of the things we were talking about earlier was the SRES.
Mm-hmm.
What is that and what does it stand for? And
SRES is a certification through NAR, which is National Association of Realtors. And the SRES portion is Senior Real Estate Specialist. It's a program that a realtor can obtain that teaches us how to deal with the senior community from all aspects of, yes, the real estate, what their issues are, getting into putting a team together from the financial side and the legal side, because we're not CPAs, we're not attorneys, but putting the people together to help the senior make an informed decision of what they need to do with their asset base, with their, as John said, the next step. Is it to sell the home? It may not be. As John pointed out, a lease situation may be best for them. But the experts as a team will help the senior make those decisions, or the family members help the senior make the decision. But the SRES program is a certification that we have that instructs us how to better help the seniors.
Okay. All right, John, you mentioned one instance where you were able to help a gentleman. One of the things we were talking about earlier was I guess we can call it a buzzword, the reverse mortgage and all the things that go along with that. What are some things that people should keep in mind when they think that might be an option for them? What are some of the things they need to be looking out for, the questions they need to ask, and the general concerns that you would have for somebody who was pursuing that option?
Kevin, it's a great question. Reverse mortgages, maybe somewhat of a buzzword right now. It's getting a lot of attention. It's an excellent vehicle created by the government. It is a government And it's designed to help our seniors figure out a way to stay in their homes, yet pull the equity from their home and have that available to them in different options. That's the simple part of it. The complex part of it is it's not for everyone. It is not a panacea for all their problems. It may actually lock them into a situation that they may not really want to be in. Could it be a better option to look at, you know, another type of aspect to handle that piece of real estate? The reverse mortgage is not for everyone, plain and simple. And every situation needs to be looked at. They need to weigh out their options and look at what works best for them.
Okay. Dan, we were talking earlier. John had an example of a story where he helped a gentleman out. Do you have a similar story, that, you know, a rewarding type of experience?
Yeah, I do. I was dealing with the children of an elderly couple that they were having to sell mom and dad's house. The parents had already moved into a community, but the home was lovely, it was nice, but it was a very emotional for the family members, the direct kids and the grandkids. And from our standpoint, or from my standpoint, you go in and I take the emotions out of it. I don't have emotions tied up in the property. We got a fair price for the property. Took maybe a little bit longer because of the market conditions, and that's something that realtors can't control, is the market conditions. But we were able to get a very good price for their property that would help them put the money in the bank and let them live in the community where they've moved into. So it's a rewarding experience to be able to help people, is what that situation was. And everything worked out very well.
All right.
Looks hey, great. Kevin?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that I was coming through clearly. I've got a question, and you know, I'm sure Dan and John, you're going to roll your eyes at this, and I can already see it. But you know, you alluded to the market conditions, and I just wonder if you could kind of comment on what you're seeing in the market, both nationally and then locally in the Dallas area. And if a family is thinking about divesting themselves of their parents' property, you know, what would you tell them? Would you tell them, you know, hang on for a year and wait for the market to turn? Do you think it's bottomed out? What advice, you know, along those lines might you give?
If the question is more or less, where is our market going in the current situation, is that what
yeah,
I'm understanding?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah. Very interesting. We have, in 2010, seen an interesting shift. Of course, when we talk about real estate, it's like the weather. If you want to know the weather forecast, don't tune into, you know, Washington, D.C. here in Texas. We have our own set of circumstances, and real estate is, of course, very particular market by market, even area by area, in an area like Dallas-Fort Worth. But what we found last year as an overall perspective of what happened in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex area, our first increase in a few years in the housing market for the average home that was priced over $250,000. And that's a very interesting situation, because that increase was about 2.4%. Very marginal, but Dallas has always been in an average of about a 3-4% annual appreciation before all of this real estate economy issue happened. So that's not too far off from where we've been for consistently over 20 years. But for the houses that were priced under $250,000, that market is still on the downside. It's still dropping. And that is very indicative of the foreclosure activity that we've had. We are posting over 16,000 foreclosures a month here in the Metroplex area, and it's and that's going to continue for a while through this year. So that's affecting especially the lower-end priced houses. But on the average of 250 and above, we're actually seeing an increase, and that's a positive sign.
Thank you. So I guess there's an analysis that a family has to go through that weighs the cost of keeping the home versus, you know, the notion that the market might turn around in a year or two if they can hang on, right?
Brad, we lost you there. Can you say that again?
Well, I'll try one more time. If it doesn't work, we'll move on.
Okay.
I was just commenting on the fact that there needs to be an analysis done by the family that balances the cost of maintaining a property, of hanging on to the property, versus the notion that, you know, the market might turn around.
I understand the question, that an analysis of with the family members of putting all the pieces together to say, do they need to stay in the home, or can they afford to move, or do they need to move? Was that the general gist of your question?
Yeah, and that's yes.
Okay. In our program, that's part of what we do. We ask a lot of questions, and one of the first ones I ask in a group presentation, one thing you need to think about, why do you want to move? Why are you considering a move? Is it financial? Is it the maintenance of the house, as we mentioned earlier? Is it moving closer to the children? What is the real reason of looking at a community? Or is it better to stay in your home? That may be where a reverse mortgage comes in, if that works for you. There's not one set answer to the, it's a great question, but there's not just one cookie-cutter answer. Everybody's real estate situation is different. Maybe they want to lease the home, as John used in his example, and move. But those are things from the real estate side that John and I put the pieces together to help folks make an informed decision.
All right, Dan, if you could give one piece of advice to seniors or their family members or loved ones who are, you know, looking into possibly selling and moving on to that next stage, what would that piece of advice be?
The one piece of advice that I would give to seniors, and this could apply to anybody also, is when you're talking about real estate, talk to a real estate professional, i.e. a realtor. We have the real-time facts, and it's not from the TV, and it's not from the newspaper that everybody sees. Talk to a realtor. Generation remembers Joe Friday and Dragnet, just the facts. That's what we deal with. We give you the facts to make an informed decision, but a realtor has those tools and the means to get you the information. So talk to a realtor if you have any real estate questions.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice, Dan. And John, what about you?
I think because of the market and all the various concerns that we all have in real estate, don't be concerned that there's only one solution to your real estate issue. There can be different options even in the current market environment.
Okay. Another great piece of advice. And if our listeners would like to get in touch with either of you, Dan, let's start with you. How can they contact you?
They can contact me through about three different ways. Mobile number is 469-878-6391. My email is dan@danborland.com, and that's dan@danborland.com. Or you can go to my website at www.danborland.com.
All right, and John?
972-231-0363. That's a key number for me. You can also reach me through my email, john.cowan@coldwellbanker.com. And website will direct you to a lot of information, jcowanproperties.com.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We really enjoyed having you on.
Thank you very much for having us.
Kevin, we thank you for being on our show. We thank our guests, John and Dan. Thank you very much. That's great information.
Thanks, Sam.
Joining us here in Atlanta, we have Octavia Jones Samba. Octavia is with Agape Hospice Care, and she is a business developer with Agape Hospice. We're going to allow her to discuss what that means. Good morning, Octavia. How are
you? Good morning, Sam. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Let's begin by the question that we always tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you get into this arena and how did you get with Agape?
Okay. I have been doing hospice since 2005. I grew up in St. Petersburg, Florida. Early on, got interested in working with seniors when I was working in a nursing home after school, in high school, and had a patient there who had some extreme pain, and no one could figure out what her pain was from. And I thought, well, let me just ask her, you know, about her pain. And she said, well, I'm in labor. And I thought, okay, well, she's 90 years old, and she's probably not in labor. And the next day I came back, and I thought, well, you know what? I can fix this labor thing because that's only temporary. I went in with a baby doll, and we delivered her baby. And she didn't have any more pain. I was hooked immediately on trying to figure out how the mind works and what's going on with seniors. And I was 17 years old then, and I've been doing it ever since.
That's a great story.
Yeah, sent me right into nursing school from there. So, yeah, I've been doing it for a while.
Well, that's great. Now, so how did you come from Florida to Atlanta?
It was just way too hot in Florida.
Really?
I actually came up here for a friend's birthday party and loved the energy of the city. And within 3 days, got a job working here because as a nurse in 1983, it was easy to find a job and just stayed.
Yeah.
And it was a weird thing to do, but I'm pretty bold.
You're good with the weather this year? Or?
I'm not happy.
I was going to say, these guys want to go to Florida, but...
Oh, man, yeah, it's interesting, but not extreme weather. Don't like the extreme heat.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about Agape? What makes them unique? What do they do that sets them apart from the competition?
Okay. In the Atlanta metro area, there are over 200 hospices, and we all have basic things that we have to provide. The thing that Agape does and that sets us apart is we are going to reach higher to serve the community. We are going to go above and beyond what Medicare guidelines say that you have to provide to a family. And by that, I mean doing things that you can't bill for and get reimbursed for. We've done things like provide wheelchairs for people who are not even on service with us. It's about being a resource to the community. So we do a lot of education in the community, educating families. And we will go anywhere to do that.
You mentioned education, and earlier before we came on the air, you were talking about the lack of education in certain populations. Why don't you speak to that and develop that idea?
Yeah. I have found since doing hospice that there are populations in the community that do not utilize hospice as much as others. And being African American, I can tell you in that community and also in the Asian communities, they underutilize hospice out of fear that hospice is giving up hope. They feel as though hospice is going to take away care and not provide what they need. So there's an inherent fear of hospice, and the approach has to be totally different.
How do you overcome? What is the approach in that situation?
Well, what I do is, first of all, I want to meet with the family one-on-one and listening to what their fears are and telling them and dispelling that and letting them know we're not giving up hope. We have doctors. We're not going to stop providing care. We're not going to take away medicines. You're going to have good nursing care. And telling them about people who have actually come on hospice and have what I call graduated from hospice. Because once they get all of the hands-on care, all of the attention they get from the nursing staff and all the other disciplines, people can actually start to thrive and do better for a while and come off of care. We've had people come off service.
You just made a comment about a fear of taking away medicines, and I hadn't heard that from any other hospice people before, but I had heard it from clients. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, is that a real fear, or why do people have that fear?
It's a very real fear because people think that you're no longer going to seek aggressive care. And they think that that means that they won't get their medications for the illness, that those things are going to be withdrawn, and they think that it's only going to they're only going to be made comfortable. So they think that it's, okay, we're going to prop mom up in the bed, make her comfortable, give her a bath, and make her look pretty in bed, but we're not going to give her any medications. They think that you won't be treated for an infection. And none of that is true. If we're caring for a patient and they've got a life-limiting illness, it all goes to comfort. You give medications so that they can be comfortable. If you have an infection, you're going to have pain and fever. Hmm. We will not deny people that. You have to treat that.
So you're not going to withhold antibiotics or penicillin?
No, absolutely not.
Now, on the other hand, though, I guess there's a line between curative treatment and treating the symptoms, for
there
example.
There is. Say, for instance, a person with cancer, we have gone as far as, in order to let the family and the patient be ready for the idea of hospice, if they want to do another round of chemo, it's a way to give us an opportunity with chaplains and social work and the nursing staff to talk to the family to get them ready for that idea of not pursuing that. Even once the doctor has said these treatments are serving no further purpose, sometimes the families need to give it one more shot.
So let me come at this from a slightly different angle. You know, for those diseases where there's no cure, for example, Alzheimer's, medications are still available that would slow down the degradation, or is there a line there that?
Well, there is a misconception about that. There are medications that will slow the progression of Alzheimer's, but in all actuality, the research shows that it only slows the progression of the illness in the early stages.
Yes, right.
And it only slows it for only 3 or 4 months. So if you are mid to late stage Alzheimer's, the medications are actually not doing any good.
Yeah. So medications that relieve symptoms, would those still be available under hospice?
Exactly.
Okay.
Specifically to Alzheimer's, let's clarify this, that disease is unique to each individual. So
exactly.
We don't want to leave any misconception out there to our listening audience. Every case is different, and every Alzheimer's case progresses differently.
Exactly. And because we do very individualized care, we look at each person individually, and the recommendations are made, and their care plan is done with the family's involvement.
Yeah. You mentioned, Octavia, spoke a term, graduating from hospice.
Yeah.
And I think that it would be great to expand that, because that will dispel some of the myths about hospice. So my question, long-winded here, build up. My question is, do you have a story that you can tell us about an individual that graduated from hospice, and give us the specifics about that?
Absolutely. We were caring for a man who was in a skilled nursing facility. He was starting to decline. It was adult failure to thrive. He'd lost a lot of weight, stopped eating, and was just failing. Within 5 months of getting the hands-on care, the CNA going in, feeding him every day, doing all of his care, and then think about all the time that he's had this one-on-one communication with the nurse, with the chaplain, with the CNA, with volunteers. He started to thrive. He gained weight. And once he gained weight, he was back walking again, doing better, and he graduated. We had a party. He graduated, no longer needed service.
And how, without, I don't want to get into details, but how long did he live after he, quote, graduated? Do you have any idea?
I sure do. He lived about a year after that, and a year later, we were called again to come back in and do service. Yeah,
that's great.
Why do you think there's so many misconceptions about hospice? Is it something that, I guess they don't have a good PR firm, or is it something that doctors aren't communicating to their patients or the families? Why do you think that more people aren't taking advantage of this wonderful service?
I think it's because they don't know enough about it. And when you're thinking about a loved one that you are seeking hospice care for, you don't want to feel like you're giving up on them. People don't want to feel, they make commitments to families, they make commitments to themselves that I'm going to take care of my loved one, and they feel as though hospice is giving up.
But is it something you think that should be discussed at the very early stages of this rather than as a kind of the last resort? Like, we have nothing else to do, so let's call hospice. But maybe if it was kind of mentioned early on, like, oh, we're going to try these three things, and then we're going to engage with hospice as part of this, and they're just part of the whole process rather than the end of the process.
Exactly. And that's what we do as far as educating people when they are in skilled facilities, assisted livings. We go in and we talk about the benefit of hospice care long before a person starts to decline, and telling families the benefit that it can be as far as giving them service that they need before they decline. Because the benefit of hospice is not just to the patient, it's to the families.
Right.
You know, it's an interesting point, and it seems to me that often the ones that resisted the most are the families, not the clients themselves or the patients themselves, because to a son or a daughter, there is an acknowledgement that mom or dad's going to die. They've got a life-limiting illness, and, you know, we're all going to die.
Right.
You know, we're
dying
from the day we're born.
But, exactly.
But it's that acknowledgement and you know, being honest with themselves, that's so hard to do, it seems. I know that was the case, when my mother-in-law passed several years ago. The family did not want to admit that, this was the end and that they should even consider hospice.
It's difficult.
But I think that's why, by having the introduction of hospice early on, I think you eliminate that, because it's just another tool in your tool belt when you're managing this.
Right.
But whereas if you've managed it and you're trying all these things to save somebody, or you think is saving somebody, you're thinking, oh, well, now if I've done this, then that means it's the end. But if it's integrated early on, it's just another tool in the tool belt you're using. It's not the
And that's
very
why
end.
Early education is so important.
Right.
And you're right, to talk about it sooner and to get the doctors to make those recommendations sooner rather than later. Because if a doctor recommends hospice to someone who has about 2 weeks of life left, there's not a lot for the hospice to do except to manage their medical symptoms. Hospice should be caring for the entire family and be a resource to the community. Mm-hmm. It's not just coming in doing skilled nursing care. If that's all you're doing, then you're not really doing the job.
Yeah, but there's just, this is an inherent problem with humans, and you see it in doctors. I have a real recent friend who died, and he was in his early 50s, and I had a young doctor that that came in and started treatment. My friend was in renal failure and refused the dialysis because of other medical complications, long story.
Mm-hmm.
But the doctor said wouldn't allow. He said, no, you're going to do the dialysis. And, I mean, it's a young doctor, obviously, not experienced, but yet we all have this drive not to give up.
Exactly.
There's something else we can do. And even in the medical profession, you know, that permeates the situation.
But the thing I think is defining the terms, is that giving up or is it improving the quality of life?
Granted,
it's all about quality.
Yeah, but you know, again, my friend's quality of life, his perception was different than the doctor's, and that's what you got to balance.
And you have to allow people to make those choices for themselves.
Right.
You know, you can't take away people's choices. You have that choice. Mm. And doctors make an oath, you know.
Yeah.
They it's their job.
Yeah. Well, stop and think.
And they feel like they're giving up.
Right.
Right, but their first part of the oath is do no harm.
Right.
That's the first part. I think they kind of skip by that, that by any means necessary.
Yeah.
It was real interesting. I was looking at one of your brochures, and it lists the services. And this might kind of catch you off guard, but hopefully you can speak to it. It mentions nutritional management. So I'd like to see if you could tell us, what are some of the specific nutritional management issues as it relates to hospice?
For instance, a person who is failure to thrive, okay? They're losing weight. Or a person who has wounds. If your nutrition is not good, your body can't heal.
Mm-hmm.
So we provide the nutritional supplements so that you can heal.
Is there a course of treatment, for lack of a better term, as it relates to nutrition, that is specific to hospice and not to...
It's specific to their illness.
Individual.
Yeah,
okay.
It's specific to their illness.
Okay.
Octavia, I know that you spent a number of years with some other hospices, and the Agape is fairly new. I think October of 2009,
correct.
Were telling me. What was it that made you want to go try your hand at a brand new business?
Well, because I'll tell you what happened. It's funny because personally, my father was on service with Agape and is currently on service with them. And I saw what they were doing. I was working in another arena, doing long-term acute care. They were doing such a fantastic job with my father. And he had been on service with another company, and I switched him to Agape. The level of care that he received, and he was still living at home with my mother, the level of care and the level of attention that was given to him was amazing. It was absolutely, they were doing, and because I know what hospice should be providing, they were doing much more.
I'm sure Ed Cox appreciates that statement.
Yeah.
You can give no better statement.
They were above and beyond anything that you can expect.
Mm.
And they're all very hands-on. We have owners that are nurses, and they are seeing patients. They're not sitting in an office saying, okay, you nurses go here, you nurses go there. They're seeing patients.
That's great. That's a great statement. We certainly appreciate that. Octavia, for our listening audience that might have a loved one that is moving to a possibility of using a hospice or they at least like to start this and explore it early, what piece of advice could you give that individual as they start this process?
I would say when you meet with your hospice representative, ask questions. Get your questions down in advance. And the things you should be asking them, are they going to provide social workers? And how often? You want to know how often these people are going to be there for you. Nurses, CNAs, do they have volunteers? Are volunteers going to be visiting with your family member? Will chaplains come out? And will they offer you respite care? Respite care is a very important part of hospice when a loved one is taking care of a family member at home.
Define that respite care for us.
Respite care will take that ill person out of the home and place them in a facility for 5 days for that family member. Family members burn out real easy taking care of someone. And for family member just complete burnout, your hospice should be offering you that respite care.
That's great advice, Octavia. We certainly appreciate that. And for our listeners who might want to reach out to Agape, to these hands-on owners or to yourself, how can they do that?
You can reach us at, excuse me, our phone number is 404-763-1456. You can reach me directly at 678-557-7305. You can call us with questions about hospice or any other senior resources. We are here to be a resource to the community.
And we appreciate that. And one point to clarify, where do you service in regards to the Atlanta?
We service the 22-county Atlanta metro area.
Octavia, we certainly appreciate good information. We enjoyed having you. We thank you for being our guest.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to remind our listening audience that if they'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of today's show, they can do so at ugeriaradio.com. And we'd like to thank our guests for being with us and remind everyone in closing that if the youth of this nation is its greatest natural resource, it goes without saying that the seniors of this nation is its greatest national treasure. Thank you and God bless.
Ugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and broadcast live from the Business Radio X studios.